Now, on the table here, I have quite a stack of books. And in your hands, you have the things that are necessary out of these books. So I've reduced it down to a manageable roar for you. Okay, let me tell you what I have first, so you can look at it afterwards. First of all, I have, as you will take this first page, I have McGill's Interlinear. And this is a Hebrew English Interlinear. Now, as you know, Hebrew reads from right to left, and their books open from back to front. And so, when you look at this, if you look at the first page there, you will see the Hebrew, and it actually goes from right to left in the Hebrew. That's why they can't put the words directly under each other like they do with a Greek interlinear. Now, there is one combined interlinear that does that, which I've seen, but you almost go cross-eyed trying to read it, because you're after reading the English word from left to right, only your eyes are moving from right to left. And it's very difficult to follow. Then it has keyed over it the numbers of Strong's Concordance. So I took one look at that in fine print and said, I don't need that. I've got these. Now, here is another book which has the clearer print, which then is on the back side of this page, which is Rashi. Now, Rabbi Rashi is the leading expert that the Jews have as far as their commentaries go. And he's noted as the leading expert. Okay? So that's one that we have. The next one that I have is the Greek Old Testament called the Septuagint. And many places in it may be suspect because of what we covered before concerning the Septuagint. But in many cases, it's very accurate. So in the cases that it appears to be accurate, I will use it and show you those. Then I have the Jewish publication, which is then the stapled version where you have the JPS-OT. That's Jewish Publication Society Old Testament. So I have this here that you can look at if you need to. Then I have the Englishman's Hebrew Concordance, which we have on this page right here, back side of this page. And the reason that I have these is this. This week, Del Holste from Santa Maria sent me some things because he's following along with the series that we're doing on Who is Jesus. And so he was very helpful in sending me some very important information, which we find on pages 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 of the stapled together material, which we will cover in just a little bit. And to just let you know that this, what we are covering, Who is Jesus, is a very important and profound subject. So if you will please, we'll start here to show, just to give you a little history of what we're doing. Take the one that is stapled together, okay? And the front page of that, in the lower right-hand portion, you find Elohim printed out with an arrow, okay? Now, this is from the commentary, Briggs, Driver, and something else. And this is the one that was quoted by Anthony Buzzard as proving that Elohim is a phrase which is used to give to human magistrates or rulers. So Del Holste sent me a copy of this, so I cut this little portion out and put it here, so let's read it. Okay, right below where it says Exodus 22, we'll read this, Brown Drivers and whatever, Briggs Brown Drivers Lexicon of the Old Testament. Now, where it says Elohim, those Hebrew letters or spelling Elohim. Then the next initials represent nominative masculine plural, NMPL. All right. Now let's come down to where you see the number one. Number one, PL in number. PL means plural. Now you see, scholars like to make it difficult for ordinary folks. They like to make it so it looks so intelligent that no one can understand it. And thereby they can hide a lot of their errors. But guess what? We got them. And I will prove it. That's why I have all of this. Okay? Elohim. Number one, plural in number. Next to it, you have like a little cross and an A. You see that? Just going, and it says in the italic print there, rulers, judges, comma, either as divine representatives at sacred places or as reflecting divine majesty and power. Elohim, Exodus 21:6. Now, you see the parentheses that comes after that? Where you have the O-N-K, and then that funny little snake-looking thing right after it? That snake-looking thing is an abbreviation for the Septuagint. You didn't know that, did you? Okay, and it says, and I'll read it to you in the Greek, but to kriterion to theou. Now that's Greek to you, and that's Greek to me, and that's Greek to everybody else, which I'll show you what that means out of the Septuagint in a minute. Now then we go on, and it lists a couple other places. Then we come down after all of those initials, and we have, starting at the left side, where it says, but gods. Small letters, G-O-D-S, you see that? Right next to that, then you have Josephus and Philo. Those are both Jewish writers. Now he is quoting, for his authority, Josephus and Philo. That's what I want you to understand. He only gave the reference there in Exodus 21:6 and 22:7 and 8, which we have here. And we'll look and see what it really says. Okay? Then we come down here according to Philo, and then it gives a lot of other references, the different things. Now you come down to, let's come down to Section B, the one with the little cross in front of it with a B. You see that? Right after that, it is divine ones, superhuman beings, including God and angels. Now, you notice what I've circled there, right? You see that funny looking, it looks like a yoke with a line down the middle of it. That is the Greek letter C, and it pronounced P-S. So guess what the scholars use that sign for? So you will never know what it's referring to. It's referring to Psalm, P-S. How about that? They try and make it so difficult that you say, okay, well, look up Brown, Drivers, and Briggs, and you will see in there. So you start looking at it, and you've got all of these abbreviations that make you go crazy, and you wonder what on earth it is. That is to the average person. So the average person will throw their hands up in the air and say, well, I can't understand that. He must be right. But we're going to see he's not right. Okay? Now, let's go to Psalm, what is that? Psalm 8 and verse 6. Yes, let's go there. Is that Psalm 8 and verse 6? And they make it so small that you need a magnifying glass to go after it so you can see what's happening. You know. It's just like the contracts that the people don't want you to read to find out what's in it. They put it in fine print. Right? Okay. Psalm 8, 6. Now, this does not prove. Okay. Let's pick it up here in verse 3. What he's trying to prove is that the word Elohim applies to, but Elohim, unfortunately, is not used here. Okay. That this applies to human beings. So what you have to do, whenever there is a quote in any of these commentaries, read what they quote. Because what they quote in Numbers, and not quoting the whole thing, may not really be true as to what they're trying to prove. Okay? Let's pick it up in verse 3 and we'll read through verse 6. When I consider your heavens and the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? You have made him a little lower than the angels. Not Elohim, angels. Okay? Angels. And have crowned him with glory and honor, and did set him over, make him to have dominion over the work of your hands, and you put all things under his feet. Okay? Now, when this is quoted in the book of Hebrews, the word for angels is angelos, which is the Greek for angels, which is almost the same as English, isn't it? Angels, angelos, not too much difference. All right? Now, all of these things here, it says, now, if we come down a little bit further, we're in the comment in the margin right there, it is, let us. You see that written in the margin? Let us. Okay? Now, then we come right on over here where it says, but angels, go across the abbreviations, clear over to God. RV is revised version, and most moderns, that means modern translations. Okay? Genesis 1:27, which says, let us make man in our image. If Philo, along with Jeremiah, D-Chi, we interpret Elohim as God's consultation with angels. And as I mentioned before, this is where Rashi says that God asked the lower for their permission to make man. Now, someone would look at that and say, oh, he is an authority. Okay, let's check all these authorities. Let's go on and just look at some of the other things that are there. Let's come down to the sixth line from the bottom. Let's notice what they have here. Books of Enoch, which is in the Apocrypha, that's in the Septuagint. And Jubilees, it's in the Septuagint. Philo, Jude, and then that's verse 6. Then again, we have Josephus. Most ancient fathers and modern critics against usage are sons of princes, mighty men. Notice the abbreviation, O-N-K and R-A-B, sons of God, the pious. What he's doing, he's quoting authorities for these interpretations other than the scriptures, okay, except one or two or three in there. Then it says, then we go down the pious, Theodosius, Christosom, Jerome, Augustine, Luther, Calvin, etc. You see how all that is in there? And the reason I went through it is because the average person in reading this would just hopelessly give up because it doesn't make any sense. Okay? So I said, aha, let me get out my handy-dandy little things, which I have here. So I got out my Rashi. Let's go to the first page where it says Elohim, God, or Judges. So if you can get out that page which says Elohim, God, or Judges, and go to the column on the left, Rashi, Exodus 21:6, Elohim. Now, let's turn there in our Bibles. Exodus 21:6. Now, Exodus 21 and 6, it says, "Then his master," that is, if verse 5, "his servant plainly say, 'I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go free,' then his master shall bring him to the judges." The Hebrew there is Elohim. Okay? So you look at that and you think, boy, sure enough, it does mean judges. So then you get out your handy-dandy little concordance, and guess what? Voila! There are only four instances where they are called judges from the word Elohim. And that is found in Exodus 21 and 22. No place else in the entire Bible is the word Elohim translated judges, period. Yet, it is put as the number one definition in Brown, Drivers, and Briggs. Okay, let's go on, because this gets even better. Look at Rashi. Verse 6, "Then shall his master bring him unto the judges." Now, I have underlined Elohim. Okay? And you will recognize the letters as we go through in the various instances. Then I put his comment here, where I have Rashi's comment. "Unto the judges, i.e. to the court, he must take counsel with those who sold him to his master." IBID. That means the same references he had previously on the subject. Now let's come down here to where I have written right below that, Exodus 22, verse 8. Let's turn there in our King James, Exodus 22 and verse 8. It says, "If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges to see whether he has put his hand unto his neighbor's goods." Now, Rashi has it this way. This is it. "Unto the judges shall come the case of both parties." Now, judges there, I've underlined again, Elohim. "Whom the judges," Elohim, "will condemn, shall pay double unto his neighbor." Now notice right in the middle of that writing, 21:13. Let's read 21:13, because here again Elohim is used, right? Let's look at it. Let's go to verse 12. Exodus 21 and verse 12. "He that smites a man, so that he die, shall surely be put to death. And if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, I will appoint a place where he should go." Now, the word God, as you look on this Rashi commentary, see that? 21:13. But Elohim. Now, he couldn't say judges, could he? Because God is the one who's involved. Now, it seems very strange that right after you get done with the first commandment in Exodus 20, "You shall have no other Elohim before me," that all of a sudden we find four places where Elohim is used for judges. Is that a correct translation, or are we on to something? Okay, now, let's go back to chapter 21 and verse 22. Come to the next column on this, Rashi, Exodus 21:22. Okay, let's read that in the King James. "If men strive and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall be sorely punished according as his... as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine." What word do you think judges is there? you would think that it should be Elohim, if the word Elohim means judges, correct? But it doesn't. It's an entirely different word. So if you will look down right below where I have Rashi's translation, you will see Englishman's Hebrew Concordance. So here is the word. Now, if you have a Strong's Concordance and you need to use that, it gives the numbers. The number 6414 is the main root, and that is always on the left. The number 64119 is a secondary use of it with a slightly different pronunciation. So it has here, and it's not Elohim. Can you see the difference between Elohim and this word, which is called Paliel? Paliel. Okay? Can you see the difference in the letters? That's all I want you to see. You see the letters for Elohim? You see the letters for Paliel. Okay? Different. This is the way, brethren, to get technically into something and to write a thesis, to put out a paper. This is part of the basic research that ought to go in it before someone presumptuously publishes something which undermines the truth of the Bible and the faith of believers. Now, let's go on. So I said, aha! What is the other word for judges that is used throughout the Old Testament? Don't you think that that would be a reasonable thing to do? Find that out? So we have it here. Now, if you need a Strong's Concordance, it is 8199. And this word is pronounced Sha'afat. Okay? Notice, and I put enough references in here, for the noun, judge. Now, there are those two words for judges. You will please note the Hebrew lettering for 8199. Is that not different than the Hebrew lettering for Elohim? Yes, it's a different word. See? I'm not trying to teach you Hebrew, but what I'm trying to do is just show you enough so we can see that what is claimed is not true. So then, let's turn it over on the other side. So I said, aha, let's get out McGill's interlinear. So it's still Elohim, God or judges, okay? Where I have McGill's interlinear. And so what I did, I cut out the same verses again. Exodus 21 and verse 6. Then shall his master bring him to the judges. And I underlined Elohim so you can see it there. You see that? Now notice what McGill does. He has a little footnote number 5. And what does that say? Number 5, Hebrew, God. So he is to bring him to God. Okay? Very interesting, isn't it? So then we go to Exodus 22 and verse 8, and we have the same thing here, verse 8. Unto the judges shall come the master of both of them, whom the judges will declare guilty. Notice, Elohim in both cases. But notice, there's another footnote here, number 4, which says, Hebrew, God. So I said, man, now we're really on to something, aren't we? We're on to something. Rashi was not honest enough to put the footnote to call Elohim what it should have been, God. Because these are the only places in the entire Old Testament that Elohim is used for and translated judges. And we're going to see that it does mean God, not judges. And that's what it literally means. All right, let's come down to the section Septuagint. Okay, now this is the Greek Old Testament. Exodus 21, you can just read it in the English. Exodus 21 in verse 6, will not go free. His master shall bring him to the judgment seat of God. Now, they've elaborated that just a little bit. They added the judgment seat, okay, which is pros to kriterion to theou, that I underlined in the Greek. Now, we come to Exodus 22. Exodus 22, and let's come down to just where I have it underlined, okay? But if the thief be not found, the master of the house shall come forward before God. Because after all, who are the judges to judge for? God. So they're literally coming before God. God is establishing the fact that they're coming before God. Now, let's come down here to the next place I have underlined. Proceed before God. Come down to the next one I have underlined, verse 11, an oath of God. Okay? Now, let's go to the stapled pages. I know it's a little out of order, but I put this together first, and then I went back and decided, well, I'll put this together. So we'll come back to the backside of page 2, because I have one slight correction on Psalm 110, which we will get to. So now I want you to take the one that says JPSOT, where I have Exodus 21. Now let's come down to verse 6. Then his master shall bring him unto God. So the official translation of the Jewish text by the Masoretes were afraid to ascribe to human beings godlike character and names, correct? So they translated it properly, God. So we have disproved any qualification of a meaning that Elohim means rulers or judges or superhuman beings. It is not a correct definition, even though some of the experts have put it in here, and their proof on that does not stand the scrutiny of thorough, minute examination. And my question is, before this booklet was written, who is Jesus? Why was this not done? Okay? Now, and as you know, when we get into some of these topics and we go in a series, that's all I'm thinking on and studying on as far as the Bible is concerned. My mind is on nothing else. That's why I don't want to go one week on prophecy, another week on something else, and come back to it, because it needs to be total concentration on what we have here, because we are up against some very sophisticated reasonings and doctrines. All right, let's go on. Let's come down to verse 22. And you'll see, and if men strive together and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart, yet no harm follow, he shall be surely fined according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. Correct translation. Okay? Paliel. Now let's come to Exodus 22. And here again we find, beginning in verse 7. If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall come near unto God to see whether he's put his hand unto his neighbor's goods. For every matter of trespass, be it for ox or for ass, for sheep, for raiment, for any manner of lost thing, whereof one says, this is it, the cause of both parties shall come before God, and whom God shall condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. Okay? What is the long and short of what we have just gone through? This proves that the correct translation of Elohim is God. It is incorrect, even according to the official Jewish Masoretic text, even according to what McGill footnoted here, that he was honest enough and had enough fear of the Word of God that he put a footnote in there so that he would have it right. And then we find Rashi, who's supposed to be the great authority on Hebrew, is not honest to do so. And then we have found that those who are writing papers and doing different things are not thorough or honest enough in their research to really find out whether that is so. The depth of their research goes to a dictionary to open it up and see what the dictionary says, and that's what they quote without any further examination. That, brethren, is not the way to establish doctrine. Period. Now, let's go back to the first page. I'm sorry it's a little out of order. Now, I need to make one correction concerning Psalm 110 and verse 1. One slight correction. Let's turn there, Psalm 110 and verse. And if we make a mistake, then we have to go back and correct the mistake, right? Isn't that true? Okay? Now, Psalm 110, we have a slight correction to make. Psalm 110 and verse 1. The Lord Yahweh said unto my Lord, and I have said on two or three tapes that this is Yahweh. This is not Yahweh, this is Adonai. Little different. Adonai can refer to Lord as God, can also refer to masters as human beings, or like my Lord, the King. So let's look at this and analyze it a little bit more and see, even though I quoted the wrong word and did not get it exactly correct, did we miss the meaning? This is a psalm of David, is that not correct? And the Lord, and we know all the way through where it is the Lord, Yahweh, that is the Lord. No question, correct? No question about it. Said unto my Lord Adonai. Who was David's Adonai? Was there any human master that David reported to? God, that's correct. Yes, absolutely. So what I did, if you go back to this little back page here, where I have Yahweh equals Lord, Adonai equals Lord. Notice the difference in the letters. Adonai applies to Yahweh and God in these following scriptures which I have given here. So I quoted all of Psalm. Next thing we need to know is, how did David use the word Adonai as well as Yahweh? Would that be the next thing to find out? Yes. So we have it here. Psalm 8. O Lord, our Lord, Adonai, our Master. Doesn't take anything away from Yahweh, does it? Not a thing. Let's come to Psalm 12 and verse 4. Now where you see 5 in parentheses, that's the King James verse. The King James verse, in some cases, as I have mentioned, is one off from the Hebrew. Okay? Where it says, who is Lord over us? Okay? Psalm 45:11, he is your Lord, and worship you him. Psalm 97:5, at the presence of the Lord of the whole earth. Who is that? That's Yahweh. Okay? But here, the term Lord of the whole earth, the term Adonai has been used to refer to God. Psalm 105 and verse 21, and he made him Lord of his house. Let's look at that one, because that's small case. Psalm 105 and verse 21. This is talking about Joseph, where he was made Lord or ruler over his house, verse 21, and he made him Lord of his house and ruler of all of his substance. That's talking about Joseph. So we have one instance where Adonai is used in that particular sense by David. Now, Psalm 110 and verse 1, we just covered. Psalm 114 and verse 7, at the presence of the Lord. Okay, so the context tells us when Adonai refers to God and when it refers to another human being, correct? And is so noted in the way that it's translated. So when we come to Psalm 110 and verse 1, we are still confronted with the same problem then, aren't we? If Yahweh said unto my Adonai, then who is David's Adonai? But the Lord. It's just another description of the Lord. So we end up with two Lords regardless of how you do it, whether it's Yahweh or Adonai. And we've seen conclusively that in a good number of cases, not all, and they are so noted, if you want to look in the concordance here, I've got a couple pages on Adonai, which talks about that. List all the scriptures, rather, not talks about that. So even though the word Adonai is there, it doesn't change what we have learned that the Lord said to my Lord. Okay, it doesn't change a thing. Now, let's go on and look at some other interesting things. And this was sent by Anthony Buzzard right here to, as we will see, to Del Holste. Now, this is talking about the Trinitarian dogma. So let's go to the one that says, the origin of Jesus, typewritten. And I'm going to send out copies with the tape, so everyone will have copies to follow along with. So let's cover a good portion of this. It's important to realize that the official Trinitarian dogma states that Jesus is really God with human nature, but not a human person. Now, that's not what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches, as we will see, that Jesus was a human person. Absolutely. This is said to be a mystery. Next sentence. Armstrong's concept of Jesus implies the same thing. Armstrongism makes little attempt to explain how God became man. Well, we just covered that last time, didn't we? That he emptied, devoided himself as being God. Or how it is possible for God to die. And that's the whole question, you see. God, as God, cannot die. But God, having relinquished being God to become human, can die. And as we saw before, nothing is impossible for God. Okay? Or how is it possible for God to die or to be tempted or not know the day of his second coming? See, so you see how it's approached here. None of these traditional problems arise once we accept that Jesus came into being at his birth. Luke's account of the birth of the Son of God should be read carefully. It's interesting that it has embarrassed many Orthodox theologians since in pre-existence Christology, a conception by the Holy Spirit in Mary's womb does not bring into existence the Son of God. And so this is written by Raymond Brown, Birth of the Messiah. Okay? Yahweh did not become the Son until he became the Son. So it is literally true that the Son, per se, did not exist for eternity, but Yahweh did. Then he became the Son by emptying himself from being God to become a human being. Next paragraph. But Luke says that Mary's conception does call into being the Son of God. For this reason, of the miraculous conception, the holy thing shall be called the Son of God. According to Armstrongism and Orthodoxy, the conception by Mary does not create the Son of God. He has been the Son of God since eternity. That's not what the Bible teaches, and I don't think that that's what the Worldwide Church of God used to teach, because I never taught that when I was in the Worldwide Church of God. And even though I was in the Worldwide Church of God, believe me, I never preached Armstrongism. As I told this lady who called me from Alabama, she wanted the long and short as to why I came into the church and why I left. So I gave it to her very simply. That I came into the church because when I heard Herbert Armstrong and Garner Ted Armstrong preaching, they said, "Don't believe me, believe the Bible. If it's not in the Bible, don't believe me." That fair enough? And don't follow me, follow Christ. And I'm not an apostle, I'm just a minister. Then all of those things changed. And so those are the same things that got me out of the church. Because it was, believe me in spite of the Bible, follow me in spite of Christ. So I said, sayonara. No more of this. Now that's the shortest explanation of going into the Worldwide Church and coming out. Obviously, I left a lot of detail out, okay? But that's the long and short of it. So, if indeed Armstrongism did teach that the Son existed eternally as the Son, that is an incorrect statement. But the one who was Yahweh existed eternally, who became the Son of God. Luke and orthodoxy cannot be reconciled. Luke does not describe the transformation of eternal being into a human being, but the creation through miraculous conception of the Son of God as a lineal descent of David, Abraham, and Adam. This is significant that Adam was also called the Son of God. All right. Now, we'll cover that a little more in detail when we get to that particular point. However, I will say here, Jesus got his human nature from Mary, from the line of David, of the tribe of Judah, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's plenty clear. Okay? Jesus referred to himself as the Son of Man and the Son of God. Now, let's go to the next paragraph here. Scholars admit that Luke knows nothing of Jesus' pre-existing his birth, nor does Matthew. Peter speaks of foreordination or foreknowledge. We'll cover that in 1 Peter in a little bit. But not a pre-existence or incarnation of a previously existing person. Peter was a leading spokesman for the church, but as we found in the last lesson, John was the one who finished the canonization of the Bible, and John was the one who has given us the revelation, the full revelation of who Jesus was. Okay, let's go on here. Judged by the standards of later orthodoxy, both Peter and Luke were quite unorthodox. Orthodoxy is built on a belief that an eternal person came into the world through Mary. But this person seems to owe nothing by way of personality to his lineal descent from David through his mother. Now that is the way the Catholics teach it. By saying that, Mary had in her conception, when she was conceived by her mother, it was an immaculate